If anyone at any point wants to take something off the record, you can either tell me then or you can tell me after, just to remove it. But by default, we're recording, and I'll be repeating questions for the recorder. So,
Holden, can I say one quick thing? Like, we did this thing where you submitted questions on your phone. Holden is old school, so just raise your hand. He'll call on you.
That.
And verbal question asking in this session.
We're doing the traditional format, and so I'm just going to talk for 10 or 15 minutes and then take questions, and it's just me. So maybe we'll try the giveaway in the future, but want to see how it works out first. So so basically, like I said, I'm gonna go through the basics of OpenFill. I think a bunch of you know the basics or have been here before, so I'm gonna go through them kind of on the quick side and happy to take more questions and try to talk a little bit more about what's been new at OpenFill most recently. But I am gonna go through the basics just so everyone is caught up on just like what we are, what we're about, how we're different from GiveWell. So basically, I obviously was at GiveWell, co-founded it with Ellie, and after several years there, we met Carrie, Tuna, and Dustin Moskovitz, who were trying to give away a very large fortune within their lifetimes, and this could be like billions of dollars. And we sort of wanted to help them and saw that the problem they were wrestling with was in some ways very similar to the GiveWell problem and in some ways very different. So the way in which it's similar is they were looking for, had a certain amount of money to give. They wanted to do as much good as possible with that money, and were having trouble finding resources, finding guidance. And so we were looking for a way to kind of help them with that and simultaneously create a better public knowledge base or common knowledge base for other philanthropists in a similar position to get up to speed more quickly in the future. But so far, that's very similar to GiveWell. A difference is just the scale and the style of the giving that they could and were going to do. So, as people who are giving away possibly billions of dollars in the course of their lifetimes, that is a very different thing from, when we started GiveWell, it was originally trying to solve the problem of how do I give away, let's say, $5,000 and I only have a few hours to think about it. So those are obviously different, and a lot of GiveWell donors do give a lot more than that, and Carrie and Dustin do give to GiveWell top charities, but they're different kind of animating or, original problems. And so some of the differences are that with Carrie and Dustin, they can spend, decades themselves getting immersed in the issues, learning to be full-time philanthropists, and can also build their own networks, hire their own staff, and start doing things that, smaller donors might not be able to, such as creating new organizations or transforming existing organizations. And so the options look very different. One of the things that we've started to hone in on at Open Philanthropy, and I don't think it's the only good kind of giving, even for Carrie and Dustin, but it's this idea of hits-based giving. And it's in some ways the opposite philosophy from GiveWell, sort of, in that rather than focus on things where we've kind of checked them out and we understand the case for them and we've established some sort of strong case that something is likely to work or has high expected value, a lot of times what hits-based giving looks like is more like trying a lot of things and expecting a lot of them to sort of dramatically fail and hoping that there will be a few successes that are big enough to justify the whole rest of the portfolio. So it's an approach that may be kind of familiar from venture capital. And when we looked at the history of philanthropy, we did feel, and we've written about this, we did feel that there were enough good examples of major wins in philanthropy that could have made up for many failures. And so we actually have conference rooms over on that side that are named after what we think are some of the biggest philanthropic wins. But one example would be that the Rockefeller Foundation funded this research on improved crops, and this is widely believed to have led to the Green Revolution that led to several countries going from very poor to developed or quasi-developed and pulling, saving more than a billion people from starvation. And so that's the kind of thing where, it would be fine to try 10 things like that and have only one of them work, and you would still feel that you got a pretty good return on your portfolio. So that's the basic philosophy. And in terms of what we do and why we do it and where we've been, OpenFill, kind of started by like studying the history of philanthropy, studying what existing foundations do, and in our first few years, we really spent our time trying to pick good focus areas. So just topics to focus on, topics to hire around, and we looked for problems in the world that we could work on that were important, neglected, and tractable. So important means, if we were to do something about this problem, if we were to get a win, it would be a big deal. It would affect a lot of people in a very positive way. Neglected means there's not too many other people working on this. So all else equal, we'd rather work on a cause where we're one of the only funders and we can be one of the, you know, transformative funders in the field, rather than working on some cause where there's already, you know, a zillion people and a zillion dollars going into it, and so we just have to play around the margins. And finally, tractability means that we see some sort of path to impact. And so, you know, to give an example of this, we looked at a lot of different U.S. policy causes. We did a lot of short investigations where we tried to get a basic idea. You know, here's a policy issue. Maybe it's criminal justice reform. Maybe it's gun control. Maybe it's education policy. And we'll ask these basic questions. If we could get a win on this issue, how big a deal would it be? How many people would it be? Would it affect? That's importance. We ask neglectedness. You know, who else works on this? Who else is advocating? How much will we be adding? And then we ask tractability. Like, do we think we can get a win? And so for our first, for our opening years, we mostly focused on picking good problems to work on. We call these focus areas, based on importance, neglectedness, and tractability. And then we focused on hiring people who could specialize in these focus areas, become true experts, a lot of times come in with a lot of existing expertise, and then lead our giving. And the overall Open Phil philosophy is pick the best issues to work on, pick the best people to work on them. That's where a lot of the hard work for people like me comes in. And then from there, let the people you've hired lead the way. Obviously, ask them tough questions, evaluate how they're doing, assess how the portfolio is performing. But overall, our strategy in a given cause, for example, you know, in criminal justice reform, our program officer is Chloe Coburn. In farm animal welfare, it's Lewis Ballard. And if someone asks, what's your strategy? To me, if someone asks, what's your strategy in criminal justice reform? My first order answer is like, Chloe, or whatever Chloe thinks our strategy should be. Obviously, we interrogate that. We ask tough questions. But the idea is that we're not set up to do one kind of intervention. And so there's no, you know, we don't say, well, we do impact investments, or we don't do impact investments, or we do advocacy, or we don't do advocacy. That's not how we slice things. We believe in picking the right issues, the right people, and then from there, there's all kinds of different ways you can do things, but we want that person to be the truly most knowledgeable expert who can do that. And then, you know, another core part of our philosophy is the minimization of decision makers and veto points. So, you know, for hits-based giving, you want to take big risks, and that means sometimes doing things that are very bold, things that maybe are not easy to explain to others, or that others would look at and not immediately understand. And if you want to do that, I think the worst thing you can do is have the whole organization vote on everything you're going to do. And I think the best thing you can do is really empower the people who know the most. And so, you know, a lot of how we've set things up, for example, our program officers generally follow what we call the 50-40-10 rule, which is that when they're giving away money or recommending grants, when we look at the portfolio, we want 50% of the dollars to be things that the, you know, the ultimate grant approvers, and those are myself and Carrie right now, things that the grant approvers really buy into, understand, could argue the case for themselves. But it's okay if another 40% of grant dollars, bring us to 90% total, are merely things that we can sort of, I can see how you could think that was a good idea if you knew a lot more than me. And so a lot of times I'll read a grant and I'll say, I don't feel sold on this, but you know the area better than I do, and I see where you're coming from, so we're going to approve this one, but it counts against that 40%. And then the final 10% of the grant portfolio tends to be discretionary, and that means we have an expedited process. The program officer doesn't really need to make a case. They just need to tell us some basic stuff about the grant, and whether or not we buy into it, it goes forward, as long as we don't see any major red flags. And so the idea there is that, you know, we're trying to focus a lot of the decision-making in the people who know the best, and we're not trying to let grants get held up by needing them to be legible to everyone involved in the organization, and even sometimes to the decision makers. So that's the basic, you know, the basic Open Phil philosophy. And now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to quickly go through the causes that we work on and kind of discuss what we've done so far. And so I'm not going to, you know, connect all the dots between the process we've used and how we arrived at each cause. That's something I've talked about at previous events. Instead, I'm just going to list the issues we work on. If people have questions about why those are the issues, I can answer them, but they were chosen based on importance, neglectedness, and tractability. And then I'll talk about sort of how they're doing. And so, you know, one of our causes that I'll talk about first is farm animal welfare. There's, you know, billions of animals being treated incredibly poorly all across the world every year on factory farms in the food industry. And we believe this is a cause that, you know, I myself am not naturally someone who would have thought to prioritize animals, not a big animal lover. But when you look at just the, you know, the magnitude of the suffering, how poorly they're being treated, and how few others care, I consider us, you know, by far the biggest and in some ways the only really major funder in this area. There are, you know, really big opportunities to help improve the welfare of animals. And they're so big, and they're so much bigger, I think, in some sense, than a lot of the other causes, that it starts to look like, in some sense, it might be a good return on investment or a good philanthropic deal, even if you value animals at only a fraction or even a small fraction as much as you value humans. So to give a sense of that, you know, a lot of the work we've funded so far has been corporate campaigns. And so people will go after a fast food company or a grocer, and they will say, you know, we do not appreciate the way you're treating chickens who are producing the eggs. The chickens are in battery cages. The cages are incredibly confining, incredibly humane. They don't let the chickens practice natural behaviors. And for a tiny amount more money per egg, you could take the chickens out of battery cages. It still won't be a good situation, but it'll be a lot better. And what's happened so far is these campaigns have been incredibly successful because you go to a corporation, you point out something that would not cost them much extra money but would have huge benefits for chicken, and you basically, you know, you make life difficult for them until they make that pledge to switch. And so we've been funding groups that do that, and so far, you know, in the couple years we've been at that, these groups we funded have generated hundreds of corporate pledges, potentially benefiting about 300 million hens alive at any time. We've also been working on broiler chicken welfare, so that's like chickens that are raised for meat. And they're, you know, it's earlier days, but over 50 corporate pledges, potentially benefiting 65 million chickens at any given time. That's from the latest sort of report from Lewis. And, you know, the size of the wins here is massive, just like the leverage on your dollar for the amount of incredible suffering you're preventing per dollar. Again, I mean, you don't have to think that chickens are the same as people to think this is a good deal. You could think they're a small fraction and still say this is impressive. You know, this is one of the only areas where we've seen, I would say, big, large-scale wins already. And it's, I think in some ways it's because it's such a neglected area that there was this low-hanging fruit and there were these wins available for the taking. But we're also working on the longer term. And so a lot of the other work we do is research on animal conditions to try to create better standards and a better understanding of what further interventions could improve animal welfare at scale. And then we're also doing a lot of funding overseas. So most of those pledges I said are in the U.S. And in fact, as I understand it, every major grocer and every major fast food company in the U.S. has now made a cage-free pledge. And so hopefully 10 years from now or so, you won't even be able to get non-cage-free eggs. But we're also looking to other countries, such as China and India, where as wealth goes up, as meat consumption goes up, the scale of additional suffering could be massive, and it could make a huge difference whether there's an active animal welfare movement or not. And so, for example, we're the only major farm animal welfare funder, maybe the only funder working in China. And so that's, you know, that's an example of playing a longer game, and it may take, you know, a very long time to see any fruits from that, whereas on the corporate campaigns, we kind of came in when there was already a little bit of momentum. And I think our funding largely turbocharged things. Criminal justice reform, it's a U.S. policy issue that we picked because we thought we saw, you know, political opportunity. We thought we saw the opportunity to sort of get, again, some shorter-term wins and to make a difference. And, you know, so far, I think we do have some initial signs of having impact, though I hope to have more in the next couple of years. But one of our grantees, one of our biggest grantees, Alliance for Safety and Justice, was, you know, played a crucial role, we believe, in an Illinois bill that passed with bipartisan support that will lead to a 3,000-person reduction at any given time in Illinois incarceration. We've also been the largest supporters of the Close Rikers campaign, which, you know, has been advocating for the mayor and the governor of New York to commit to close this horrible Rikers jail, which, as we understand it, would necessitate actually making reforms and lowering the jail population because there's not really any other way to do it. And since we did start funding that campaign, there has been an announcement from the mayor that they do want to close Rikers. There's been a plan. The plan is 10 years. That's too long, in our opinions, in the campaign's opinions. The governor has now publicly gotten in a spat with the mayor where the governor says they should be trying to close it faster. So that's all been interesting. And none of this, don't want to give any impression that we think this is all due to Open Fill. All the impact we have grantees. The grantees, you know, have partial credit for the good things that happen, and we have partial credit for the good work our grantees do. So that is, you know, that is the basic philosophy there. Other major causes we work on, I would say we haven't seen as much results yet because they're kind of inherently longer term in the way that we think about the time horizons. So one of the major concerns for us is, you know, what we call global catastrophic risks. So can you imagine, you know, anything that might happen in the next 50 or 100 years that could be so far-reaching and global and catastrophic in scale as to derail civilization in a way that could affect very large numbers of future generations? Because that would be another way to get very good bang for your buck, is if you could, you know, prevent something really bad like that. So to give a well-known example, you know, nuclear war or climate change, those are both things where if you play a small role in reducing the risk that one of those really knocks civilization off course, you could then have a small role in better lives or, you know, existing lives for many, many future generations. The two biggest global catastrophic risks that we see are pandemics and artificial intelligence. It would be a bit of a can of worms to get into exactly what we're thinking behind both of those, and I'm happy to answer questions. But briefly on pandemics, you know, we think that, so first off, there was a pandemic immediately following World War I that killed significantly more people than World War I had killed, and only happened in about a year. And so the potential for a pandemic in today's interconnected world to go global and really do a lot of damage is big, and especially as science and synthetic biology advance, the, you know, the kind of nature of the risk we think could be getting worse. And so some of the things we've worked on there, we're working on trying to support and kind of keep operational the Biological Weapons Convention, which is an international agreement that basically no government should be working on developing or potentially deploying biological weapons. We think that's very, very important. Governments, state actors are kind of best positioned to design the things that could really cause worst case scenarios. And we believe that that is a bit of a vulnerable institution that we are trying to help out, basically in some sense by they're kind of in a liquidity crunch, and we're trying to figure out a sustainable way to do something about that. And then we've also funded some just like major organizations to free them up more to think about worst case scenarios in biosecurity. And that includes the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which had a dormant biosecurity program that we're, you know, recently decided to make a grant to kind of bring that program back. And then on potential risks for advanced AI, I won't go on too long about this now. I might have to take a break in the middle to get to it if I get a zillion questions. You know, basically we believe that if artificial intelligence was designed that was able to do certain things, such as science, in a superhuman way, the way that today we have artificial intelligence that can play Go or chess better than humans, that could be a civilization-defining moment, and there are major risks there. Risks both pertaining to, it would be really bad if, let's say, North Korea was the first to develop or deploy that kind of AI, because it could be kind of have military implications, or two, you know, an AI that was incautiously designed or deployed could lead, we think, to globally catastrophic accidents. And so a lot of what we do here is we try to build a field of people who are preparing for potential risks. We have no idea when this might happen or if it will ever happen, but we think there's a decent chance it could happen within our lifetimes. And if it does, we would like the world to be prepared. We would like there to be fields full of people who have spent their entire lifetimes thinking about what could happen and what we would do about it. And we have studied past histories of philanthropists trying to build fields, and we're trying to apply our lessons. So, for example, we've been funding both senior researchers to devote more of their labs to AI safety research, and we've also been, we recently had a fellowship program that deadline just closed to get more junior researchers to be able to base their careers around the idea of AI safety and not just around AI capabilities. Finally, we do a lot of scientific research funding. We have a science team, and that's something I know at past events I've often talked about how we are still figuring things out. And we still are to a degree, but we have more of a system now. And again, with science, we look for things that are neglected, that have huge potential to change the world. You know, some of what we do is directly relevant to other causes. So we've made an investment in Impossible Foods, which is trying to design a burger essentially from plants that can really compete with a meat burger, and that could greatly reduce animal suffering as well as other issues. And then we're also, you know, now funding some work around trying to create a broad spectrum antiviral, so a drug that could affect a lot of different viruses and therefore could be very useful to stockpile for a worst case pandemic. We also did a program where we went to the government main funder of biological research, the National Institutes of Health, And they have this high-risk research program where they fund especially bold ideas that is very small, and they don't fund the vast majority of them. So we basically took all of the proposals they had rejected, went through them again, and funded some of those ourselves, and that led to some interesting stuff. So that is, you know, most of what we're working on now. There's a lot going on at OpenPhil, and because of the fact that we often, you know, we often try to empower people to be the experts. We there's a lot of things that, you know, are just happening that I only understand at a high level, but I will do my my very best to answer questions about what we're doing and, you know, and what the progress has been so far. And then I'll probably take a break in the middle to talk about just what, you know, what we're looking at going forward and what our major priorities are now. Questions? Yeah.
Can you give an example of something that's not legible, you know, at your level of knowledge? And, you know, sort of walk us through it a little bit.
Can you clarify?
When you talk about how the 40% are things that you think may be plausible, but you can't really tell for sure, or you're not 100% sure, you agree?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of grants. So the question is, can I give examples of grants that are kind of not fully legible and that might get classified as this in this 40% bucket, the bucket of, sure, I can see where you're coming from, but I don't really buy into it. And there's just a lot of grants that... the biggest case for the grant comes down to how you feel about the people involved, whether you think they're good and whether they're going to get things done. And that's something that, you know, a lot of times the best way to get a read of people on the people involved is to know everyone in the field and to hear what everyone is saying about everyone else and triangulate and try to figure out who is good based on who you've seen do good work, what they say about other people, what other people say about them. And so a lot of times a write-up comes to me and it says, for example, you know, I want to fund this group that organizes people to create more of a voice for criminal justice reform. And I'll say, well, obviously, like, if you did a great job of that and you mobilized a lot of people and you deployed them very strategically, you could make an enormous difference. But I don't know these people and I don't really know how to evaluate, you know, whether they're the best people. And I, like, don't fully understand how all the pieces fit together in the strategic picture. Like, I can understand at a high level that having grassroots advocacy, having people stand up and make noise is good, but a lot of times this group might be in Florida, and I don't know everything about the situation in Florida and how, you know, how important it is to have more grassroots advocacy versus more lobbying. And so, you know, sometimes I really ask all the questions I've got, and I say, okay, I think I get it, and I think I would bet on this myself. And sometimes I say, okay, this basically makes sense to me, but rather than trying to investigate the whole thing myself, we're just going to put it in that 40% bucket. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, in the back.
Thanks so much. On your website, you list one of your focus areas also as global health. And there you say that you support a lot of the areas that GiveWell does. But I'm just wondering if you could reflect upon that, particularly in light of your criterion on neglectedness, given that many of the issues that GiveWell focuses on are not neglected.
Sure. So what's our take on global health, and particularly with respect to neglectedness? First, I'll register a bit of a disagreement. I think global health is extraordinarily neglected. I think the things that GiveWell works on are extraordinarily neglected. So, you know, if you look at how much developed countries spend per person on healthcare, and then you look at how much is being spent for somewhere, you know, for various places that GiveWell is trying to work in, I think it's you know, it's out of kilter. And I think when I look at the GiveWell situation, There's situations where you might have whole regions of Africa where 50% plus of children have these parasitic infections, and it costs 50 cents a year to treat those infections with these pills, and it would cost maybe a few $100 million to cover the whole world in this stuff. And, you know, that would be, I mean, peanuts compared to what is normally a line item in a federal budget, and even to some degree not a huge number in the context of foreign aid generally, but that gap is still there. So I would call those, you know, I would call those very neglected areas. There are areas we work on that the field is even smaller, there's even less money going into it, but I definitely think the global health and GiveWell's top charities pass the neglectedness test. Yeah, I mean, basically, I think the work, like, I've talked about hits-based giving, and I've talked about the kind of things we support, and I'm very excited about it, but I also don't think that we have established yet, or necessarily ever will establish, that this is actually better than the kind of work GiveWell does. I think it's still very much an open question, and from everything I've seen so far, I think there is a reasonable case that the good you can do through GiveWell, especially if you're not really on board with some of these arguments about animals or about the value of preventing extinction, you know, the value you can do through GiveWell is quite competitive with a lot of the stuff we found. So basically, we think that GiveWell's recommendations are some of the best giving opportunities out there. And we continue, as we recommend things to Carrie and Dustin, we continue to recommend a significant level of support for those top charities. We haven't recommended maxing it out. We haven't recommended filling the whole gap. But we've recommended a significant level of support. And just to be clear, that is our work on global health right now, so we don't do anything else. It's possible that in some future date, we'll say, what if we took an open fill approach to global health that had more to do with, let's say, advocacy or, you know, doing something that might not pay off for 30 years, et cetera. We might do that someday, but we might not. And we may just continue to say, look, GiveWell's top charities look approximately as good as anything we'd be able to find, and we'd like to continue to recommend support to them. It's also the case that GiveWell increasingly branches out and gets more into high-risk, high-reward stuff themselves. So I don't know if GiveWell talked about this at the session, but they're certainly looking into things that revolve around advocacy and revolve around taking bigger risks. So, you know, in some ways, they might end up doing what we would do on global health anyway. And I think for the foreseeable future, our global health strategy is just to follow GiveWell's recommendations.
I apologize if this is easily available on your website, but just roughly how much money does OpenPhil per year, and roughly how does it break down between the categories?
Sure. How much are we granting per year, and how much does it break down between the categories? So it's been, I mean, last year was between 100 and 200 million, and this year I predict that it will also be between 100 and 200 million. It definitely, you know, in terms of how it breaks down between the categories, it's like, generally, most of our cause areas are going to be like tens of millions of dollars. So I rattled off a few cause areas: farm animal welfare, criminal justice reform, scientific research, potential risk from advanced AI, pandemic preparedness. Those are the bulk, and those are tens of millions of dollars each. So that's to give some idea. I don't really want to get too more precise than that, but that's the idea.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yep. It's not counting GiveWell top charities. Also.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's not counting the gifts to GiveWell top charities. So the 75 million this year that the Good Ventures is giving to GiveWell top charities would be additional to that.
So do you have a handful of areas that are not current focus areas that are kind of on your radar, but for some reason they're not because they don't meet one of the three criteria? But like, what are some of the top ones of those that just they're not quite in there yet because they for some reason they don't feel there's somebody else doing it right now and you think they're doing a good job, or because you think they're impractical or whatever?
Sure. So what are some, you know, potentially promising areas that are not on our list of focus areas? I mean, certainly we're big fans of focusing, picking a very small number of things to work on and focusing on them very intensely. So there's lots of great causes that are not on our, you know, not in the list I rattled off. There are some areas that we work on in a bit of a more restricted way, or it's just like we don't have a full-time person on them. So we have done some work on climate change, reducing the risks of climate change. We have some of the other policy areas listed on our website. So macroeconomic stabilization policy, land use reform, immigration reform. These are three areas that we think various aspects of them are really under the radar and could do a huge amount of good, and we think they're very promising. But for one reason or another, often because we haven't found the right person to take them on full time, we don't have like a full time person working on them, and so we might give something more in the millions to a cause like that. There's like a zillion causes that we don't work. I mean, any cause you name, that I haven't named, probably we don't really work on it, or we've worked minimally on it. And there's tons of causes that I could say they're reasonably important, they're reasonably neglected, they're reasonably tractable. The things we work on are the ones where they've either been such a standout on some of those criteria, or they've been like very strong on those, and we found the right person to work on them. And so, you know, the choice of person is really integral to everything we do, and so that can affect what causes we go into. Like we have in the past said we're interested in multiple causes, we're going to try and hire for multiple causes, but if we get the right person, we'll do it, and if we don't, we won't. Yep.
I'm trying to understand a little bit more sort of the difference between the GiveWell model and the open philanthropy model and really sort of the longer-term view. So as I think I understand it, like you have kind of different origin stories, you certainly have slightly different strategies in terms of kind of point of view and what you're trying to invest in. The GiveWell story is about like how you direct individual donors sort of in general and
yeah.
direct their funds in smart ways, whereas like your origin story is around or the open philanthropy origin stories around like high wealth. Is there any reason why you wouldn't also like adopt more of kind of a GiveWell strategy in terms of trying to encourage just regular individual donors to invest in what you're investing in?
Sure. So talking more about GiveWell versus open philanthropy, the contrast in styles and the contrast in audiences. So you're right that the origin stories are different, but that doesn't mean that the target audiences always have to follow that exact pattern. So I do think GiveWell top charities are an excellent giving opportunity for people like Carrie and Dustin, for major donors. And also, it is the case that individual donors might be interested in some of the stuff we do. I think that one, the second one, is trickier because I think if an individual donor says, hey, you know, I'm interested in criminal justice reform, but I don't really understand why you did this. Can you tell me? Can you, like, tell me where to give and why? We're going to largely say, like, that's not how we work. Like, I've kind of described the philosophy. Like, we work hard to pick the cause. We work hard to pick the person. Then there's a lot of deference, and there's a lot of trust building internally. And so a lot of times, you know, for the individual donors, your option is sort of you can decide largely based on pretty limited info that you trust OpenPhil's judgment and you're willing to go with it or not. But it's not, you know, OpenPhil does not provide the same level of thorough, legible research. So with GiveWell, you know, you can really go to that website and whatever you're wondering, whatever you're skeptical about is probably addressed and you can probably find it and it's probably addressed out in the open. And so those are different models. And so, you know, people in either camp can give to either side, but I think that is a difference in style, which means that if you're an individual donor, you probably don't want to do the OpenPhil stuff unless you just have a lot of trust in the people and the worldview and the approach. You're not, you know, it's not the it doesn't have that same like robustness and legibility of the case. Now, I also know that a lot of GiveWell donors give to GiveWell top charities because they trust GiveWell's approach and not because they personally have checked everything out, but at least they know that the details are out there and that, like, you know, one could check them out and that the whole case has been spelled out. And I think there's just like a different level of having to cross that chasm when you deal with OpenPhil. So, but that said, I mean, yes, like they're more kind of different styles. And one of them, I would say, is more hits-based and more based on this kind of, like, deep context and relationships and trust. And the other one is more based on this, like, very thorough research that kind of covers the whole, you know, the whole chain of thinking. And, you know, certainly a donor of any size could be interested in any of those giving opportunities. Yep.
How much control do you try to exert over the organizations you fund? Like, suppose there's a group that or let's say the program officer, they like what they do and they want to give a grant to them, but they feel pretty strongly that they can do better than their current approach. Do they try to steer in the direction?
Sure. So the question is, you know, how much do we kind of try to control how the funds are used or how the organizations we're funding behave? Let's say that we like an organization, we want to fund them, but we also have big disagreements with what they're doing. To what extent would we say, here, you can have the grant, do what you want, versus here you can have the grant, but only if you do A, B, and C. And this is an example of something that I would say, you know, my first order answer, again, is we outsource this to the experts, to the program officers, because I think there's no one right answer here. We have tried to, so there's no one right answer in that sometimes it's better to just let the grantee do what they're going to do and reason that they know their work better than you do. And sometimes it's a good idea to kind of recognize they have a weakness, that weakness has been spotted, and we need that weakness addressed in order to fund them. And then there's all kinds of in between. Like, a lot of times what we end up doing is there might be an organization that has slightly different values or emphasis from us, and we try to make sure that certain people within the organization are in control of how the funds are spent instead of it being the CEO. Or we might try and make sure that the money is used for a certain cause. So there might be an animal welfare organization that does work on, you know, endangered species and on farm animal welfare. We think the farm animal welfare work is more important. That's our priority. We think it affects more animals, affects them more deeply. There's more good to be done there. And so we would say, please use this money only for farm animal welfare. But, you know, there have been all kinds of places on the spectrum. And, you know, one thing we do is we try to encourage our program officers to take a little bit of a similar mentality to the organizations as what, you know, OpenPhil takes to the program officers, which is like, when in doubt, trust. When in doubt, you know, they probably know more about their work than you do. Like, you should always be asking yourself, am I doing more harm than good by kind of trying to be too controlling here? And we have tried to nudge program officers away from being too controlling and tried to establish a strong default of freedom and deference, and being skeptical of yourself when you think you know how to do someone else's job. And that said, there are times when a program officer makes a really convincing case that, you know, here's a new scrappy organization, they've got a lot of energy, they've got some great ideas, they are not experienced at running an organization, and they are making this rookie mistake. And we are going to ask them not to make that mistake. We're going to ask them to do things differently. And so there's all kinds of situations like that. And I think it just, you know, it's a judgment call. I mean, sometimes you feel that you understand the situation well enough. And since our program officers are experts, a lot of times they really do understand the situation, and can see that something needs to be done and a grantee, you know, needs to have some weakness addressed. And other times we need to just say, you know, we will register our opinion, but it's ultimately the grantee's call. Yep.
I struggle to find political giving recommendations with any data behind them at all. Given that individual philanthropists are limited in how much they can give, have you considered starting an organization that could give public political giving recommendations?
Sure. Have we considered starting an organization that could give public political giving recommendations? I mean, it's not a priority. I think we have, you know, definitely have our hands full, and GiveWell is generally, you know, is not political, and they are the ones that are more focused on, like, disseminating information to help lots of individual donors. We're more in a mindset of, like, we try to figure out the best thing to do, spend the money as well as we can, and then give people enough window into our work that they can see the basic way in which we're thinking and learn some things from us. But at the same time, I mean, if we're, you know, for example, if we're working on criminal justice reform, there might be something in the middle of a legislative session where if we put out too much detail on what we're thinking, you might have opponents who would go and adversarially use that. And so I think that intersection of trying to, you know, trying to, for example, do advocacy, you know, and also trying to be totally open about every step of your thought process, I think there is a bit of a tension there. So that's, yeah, basically not our priority. And I think we, you know, we have these two. Open philanthropy does do some work on advocacy, but would generally not be trying to, like, blast out a recommendation to the whole world, because we think that often will do as much harm to the ends we have in mind as the recommendation could do good or more. So yeah, I think someone could potentially find a way to make that work, but it would be a very different mission from either what GiveWell is doing or for what Open Phil is doing. So we're not currently doing it. Yeah, in the back, Jake.
Give an update on how you're thinking about comparing across the different cause areas and whether and how you think about the value of diversification if there is any.
Yeah, sure. Can I give an update on how we prioritize across different cause areas? Maybe now I'll go through my final little set of points about just what our priorities are from here and what we're trying to do this year. Obviously, a lot of what we work on is just the whole grant making flow. And so trying to give away, you know, triple digit millions each year is always work, and our program officers are totally busy with it, and it's something that I work on as well. But also, you know, aside from that, in terms of organization-wide priorities, some of the biggest open items for us and some of the biggest things we're working on, one of them is what Jake just brought up. So we did pick causes that we thought were especially promising, but what we didn't do yet is decide what is the relative priority of the different focus areas we have. In the end, when we reach peak giving, which we're not at yet, how much money should be going to each different kind of cause and how much money should be going to each cause? And I think That is a major project. It's kind of been going on all year. I expect it to go on for a while longer. It is challenging because, you know, sort of in a perfect ideal world, you would have some units for good accomplished, like lives helped or something, and you would compute them per dollar for each grant, and you would compare and do the best stuff. But in reality, we often don't really have a way of estimating that, and we have to just kind of look at more heuristic approaches, like funding good people, working on important issues. And two, there are these, like, giant judgment calls. So, you know, you heard me mention the thing about animals. There are some people who feel that we should care about chickens some fraction as much as humans, maybe 10%, and those people might conclude that farm animal welfare is a far better use of money than other causes. And there are other people who think we basically shouldn't care about chickens at all. And it, for multiple reasons that we have written about and will soon write more about, We do not want to just take the entire organization in a direction where everything we're doing comes down to resolving that very kind of hazy question one way or the other. And so especially because we believe we see outstanding opportunities to do farm animal welfare work, and we also see outstanding opportunities to do other work. And so it would be a shame if we like left half of those on the table because we just took our best guess on this one very hazy question that we could easily change our minds on, you know, every week or something. And there's other big picture judgment calls like that too. Like, you know, when you think about trying to prevent events that might derail civilization for future generations, you know, if you were to make a contribution to preventing an event like that, do you want to count that as, you know, sort of 7 billion people helped, which is the world population, or do you want to count it as like 7 trillion trillion people helped, which is how many people could exist someday in the future, or do you want to count it as a much bigger number? That and so, you know, those are some of the challenges we face, and I think in order to get a coherent story of, you know, how much money do we want to put into each kind of philosophical position on what counts as doing the most good? And then within those, how much money do we want to put into each focus area? I think in order to get that right, we need to grapple with a whole variety of issues. Some of them relate to the animals versus humans question and touch on issues in philosophy of mind and animal behavior and whether animals feel pain and all kinds of things that we've written about. And, you know, we have to engage with also, like, the philosophy of what you do when you're uncertain in this way and when you're making these tough choices. So there's a lot of literatures to go through, a lot of kind of discussions to be had. Think in the end it'll end up looking something like the GiveWell cost-effectiveness analysis, where there's a lot of judgment calls, and the best we can do is kind of lay them out very clearly, have different staff members make them, ask Carrie and Dustin to make them, put them online so other people can challenge them, and then go with our judgments. And I do expect there will be an update this year that will have some preliminary high-level statements about how much money we expect to put into what kind of giving. But I think it could easily be another year before there's something really tangible that says, okay, this much money in this cause, that much money in that cause, and it could be longer than that. So that's a major kind of cross-organization project that we're working on. Other things that we're working on, we're still trying to build out better operations, and so we're still, you know, doing a job search for a director of operations, trying to get ourselves to the point where, as an organization, we're more self-sufficient, not sharing staff with GiveWell anymore. That's a place we're trying to get. Another thing we're working on is self-evaluation. So it's just starting to be the case that we have, you know, we have major portfolios that have been around long enough that we're starting to see impact, or could reasonably expect to start seeing impact. So we've just started working on these kind of portfolio reviews where we go back and try to say, okay, we made a bunch of grants. With those grants, we made a bunch of predictions, and we have actually tried to systemize, you know, that we make as many predictions as we can when we make these grants. And then we look back and we say, how did reality play out compared to our predictions? How much impact do we think we had? Are we getting a good deal for the money? So developing that process is a major focus that we're working on right now. And the final thing that is a lot of, you know, a lot of the emphasis of what we're doing is kind of self-critique or questioning the assumptions behind various causes. So, you know, we work on criminal justice reform. We believe there's too much incarceration in the U.S. But, you know, David Rudman, who does literature reviews for us, basically did a massive report where he went through all the literature he could find on, if you reduce incarceration, will you increase crime, and by how much, and how much should we value that? And so he did this sort of epic report that I really recommend. I really, it's very interesting if you are interested in the kinds of things that I'm interested in, which most people aren't, like, you know, econometrics. But that's an example of kind of going really deep, trying to take the basic premise of our work, like we want to reduce incarceration, and question it. And we have a bunch of other projects like that that are either recently wrapped up or going on. So we did a somewhat intensive investigation of, like, how good the case really is that getting chickens out of cages is good for the chickens, because some people were arguing the opposite side. So we have a write-up on that. Thinking about, you know, how reasonable it really is to think that very powerful AI could happen within our lifetimes. That's something we're working on, and in terms of trying to make more specific predictions so we can tell in the coming years if things are evolving more or less compared to, you know, how we thought they would. And then also looking at, like, how bad we think a pandemic could get and what would be the worst pandemic. So that's another major thing that happens, like, across causes at OpenPhil. So anyway, so those are some of the major projects. And Jake, the answer to your question is like, there will be a small update soon, but it's a big undertaking. We're not there yet. Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of AI safety, what do you think is the role of the private sector? So you talked a lot about trying to change direction of research, I guess both in academia and in industry, but private companies have so much money. Are you worried that Google or some company puts out even more money than you guys and say, let's do research on capability and not care about safety?
Sure. So what is the role of the private sector in AI? And, you know, I've mentioned kind of wanting there to be a major field of people who think about AI safety, not just capabilities. So how much should we worry that a company like Google could just do, you know, so much work on capabilities that it drowns out everything we're doing? And I think it's totally valid. I mean, I think, you know, it's increasingly the case that in the field of AI, a lot of where most people most want to work is industry. And a lot of the groups that are doing the best work is industry. And as a philanthropist, there's often, you know, not much we have to offer a company like Google, and not much, you know, not much opportunity for us to engage with them. We do have, you know, a major ongoing financial commitment to OpenAI, which is a nonprofit that is otherwise very similar to an industry lab. So that's at least a chance to sort of, you know, be involved in one case of that. But I would say the answer is, you know, first, I mean, what's important to us is that there be a field of people who are very thoughtful about safety, who can provide good advice to whoever needs that advice. And so, you know, even if there is a medium-sized field in academia and those people are helpful on safety and eventually Google needs to go to them for advice, we'll feel that we made, you know, a big difference and did a good thing relative to if there's just no one to go to. And second, you know, we think that the more these ideas gain currency, the more quality academic work is done on topics relevant to safety and showing that there is work to be done and there are important conversations to be had. We think that, you know, one could reasonably advocate to groups like Google to put more effort into these things and pay more attention to them and hire their own safety teams. And certainly, you know, Google DeepMind does have a safety team. And I think part of the reason for that has been the concerns that have been raised by a bunch of, you know, tiny nonprofits. So I think it can happen. You know, tiny nonprofits can affect the decisions made by big corporations and governments. We've seen it happen many times, and we think we've been part of it sometimes. Yeah.
Can I donate to Open Philanthropy based on specific categories, cost categories?
Can you donate to Open Philanthropy for specific categories? So Open Philanthropy does not take donations from individuals. We're just not set up to do that. You could check out the Effective Altruism. I think they're called the Effective Altruism Funds. And those are set up by category. Those are set up by cause. So basically, there are these funds that were set up by another organization. And some of those funds, basically, you give to the fund, and then the fund manager decides what to do with the money, and some of those fund managers are Open Philanthropy staff. So, for example, Lewis, who works on farm animal welfare and is here, he is the fund manager for the Effective Altruist Fund for Animal Welfare, and so you could give there. But that is distinct from Open Philanthropy. That is like a fund that people are trying to leverage Lewis's expertise, and there's a few of those, so you can Google that. Yep.
Have there been non-trivial grants yet that you felt like are failures in the evaluation, or that they're meaningful negative lessons from?
Yeah. Have there been non-trivial grants yet that we think are failures that we have meaningful lessons from? Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think, you know, a lot of the work we do is just so long-term that it can be too hard. It could be too early to assess it. But there have been grants where we've either made the grant and said, hey, you know, these people just don't seem to have made much progress and I'm not excited to continue supporting them. Or, you know, in some cases, just like really didn't accomplish what they set out to. So there's, you know, one program we tried that was trying to match Haitian farm workers with these visas that are unlimited in the U.S. And we were hoping that it would cause, you know, farm workers to be able to come to the U.S. and make a lot of money for them, which they could take home to their families. And, you know, basically the recruitment just wasn't where we hoped it would be, and the return on investment for the grant wasn't where we hoped it would be. So, yeah, certainly that's happened. And I think sometimes we're going to write publicly about that when we think it'll be educational for people and when we think it'll be interesting and when we think people will be wondering. And a lot of times we're just going to keep that in-house and try to be very open about it, you know, as we discuss things internally, because we, you know, we do have in that way a little bit different orientation than GiveWell, where our attitude is sort of we can do a lot of harm to our programs by putting too much information out in public, and we can endanger our relationship with partners and grantees. And so for us, what we want to do is like be really clear internally and then share things externally when we feel the benefits of doing so outweigh the costs.
do you have cases where you've thought about a cause and really think it's important, but then you go out and there just aren't any organizations that you can give grants to that are going to do what you think needs to get done, and so you feel like there's a need there, and you found those, and what do you do, or have you thought about what you will do when that happens in there?
Sure. Are there causes where we think the cause is really important, but we just can't find any organization that's doing what we think needs to be done? Yeah, there's lots of that. And we handle it differently a bit depending on how we've prioritized the cause. So, you know, we've written a bit about science, policy, and infrastructure. And this is something where we've seen a set of issues and complaints about how the whole scientific research process is, you know, how government funding for scientific research works and how the academic system works, that may not be giving people the right incentives and the right support to do really high-risk transformative science. And we tried, you know, we wrote about what we wish someone would do and what we'd love to fund someone to do, and we made a bunch of calls saying, we would love to fund this, do you know anyone? And we got nothing, and we just haven't done anything. And someday we might come back to that. We still keep an eye out, but that is definitely an example of that. I think on immigration reform, that's been another one where we kind of, you know, we've often just felt like there's lots of work we would fund and just no one is doing it, and we've kind of given up on trying to find it. So that happens sometimes. Other causes that are sufficiently a focus area, like if we have a full-time staffer on them and they're important enough to us, you know, with a bunch of the current focus areas we work on, I mean, certainly with AI, there have been some things where we've said someone really needs to be doing X, and we'll just pound away at it. You know, we'll sort of like say, we'll write up why we think someone needs to be doing X and what X is, and then we'll just kind of keep kind of almost headhunting to find the right person to do this. And this is something that, you know, philanthropists have done before. So the Sandler Foundation, I think we wrote a blog post about them, and they're actually like near here. They're like a 10-minute walk. And they've had some interesting successes sort of doing that model where they say, here's an organization we wish existed. They make a lot of phone calls. They ask if anyone, you know, knows anyone who could run it. And they kind of headhunt and they kind of pitch to the person and they say, will you do this job? Because we will fund the heck out of it. I think it is an interesting philanthropic model, and it's one that sometimes we failed at, sometimes we succeeded at.
Curious, given your interaction with Goodwill and shared history and all that, how much you thought about the interaction with your priorities and what impact it would have on Goodwill as an organization? Specifically, you say you partially fund their top charities, but you made this decision not to fund them up to their, you know, room for funding. You know, it's not having thought about it deeply, it's not clear to me if you did go up to their level of room for funding, what effect that would have on Goodwill? Would it be that now they've lost the reason for being, you know, because it sounds like you have funds at your disposal that you could do that for at least, you know, 3 or 4 years. You know, it's unclear whether that would be good or bad for Goodwill. Would it be that now you would unleash, like, all this, you know, sort of productive energy that they have in their organization to do research on other organizations because they can say, all right, you know, the 5 most important charities are fully funded. Now we're going to take all, you know, the staffing ability we have and go look for other stuff. Or would it be negative because now, you know, potential donors see, you know, all right, you know, this stuff's getting funded, I'm not going to go to Goodwill for recommendations anymore. Just curious, you know, if that's something that plays into your, you know, decision-making process at all levels of funding.
Sure. So how do we think about GiveWell and what effect we could have, positive or negative, by greatly increasing support to their top charities? And how do we weigh, you know, would that help GiveWell? Would that hurt GiveWell? This is something we thought about more in the past. So a few years ago, you know, we were in this kind of situation where we said, look, if we fully funded the top charities, just to be clear, that would not be the end of GiveWell. There's no way on earth that would be the end of GiveWell. That would, you know, because then you need GiveWell to keep making those recommendations and keep doing that research. And so that is not the issue. What it might be the end of is other donors to GiveWell top charities. So I think it would be quite rational, and I think it would be kind of weird not to do this, where if you as a donor saw us doing that, you might say, huh, guess I'll never give the GiveWell top charities again. Because, you know, every dollar I give is just like causing OpenPhil to spend a dollar less. So unless you want to donate to OpenPhil, which some people do, but which, you know, probably most of these donors don't, I think it would be the end of that. And I think that is a bit of a cost. And so I think, you know, that for a time, we didn't want to do anything irreversible. We didn't want to kill a potentially like large and growing constituency and source of money for GiveWell when we weren't sure how they would fit into our priorities and how much money we were going to want to put there. And if in the end we had decided, you know, GiveWell Top Charities are the best opportunities we can find. They're better than anything else we can do. I think we eventually would have just swallowed that and said, we got to make sure those are fully funded. We can't leave that on the table. And on the other hand, you know, we're probably ending up going in a different direction. So I think what we're largely saying is, you know, there are, at least under certain assumptions and under certain worldviews, there are things you can do that if you're willing to take a bit of a philosophical leap and willing to take more of various kinds of risk, that you can do a lot more good per dollar than GiveWell's top charities. And we want to reserve, you know, the vast majority of what we're doing for those, you know, what we consider potentially more promising opportunities. Don't want to say they're like, you know, categorically better giving opportunities. I think you have to swallow something to get that extra impact. You have to swallow something like, you know, for example, the idea of helping chickens instead of humans, or the idea of, you know, counting future generations in a certain way. And you have to swallow other things about, you know, how confident can you be in the case and how much trust you need to have. But, you know, we basically do feel that we want to reserve a lot of the capital for giving opportunities that we think are a lot better under those assumptions. And then we think we want to reserve still a chunk of the capital for, you know, the worldview that says, okay, you know, GiveWell Top Charities are the way to go, and we're not comfortable with these other assumptions you have to make, and so we're reserving some. And so, you know, we don't know what the exact numbers are going to be yet, and when we put out the blog post, which will be sometime in December, it will hopefully give a little bit more detail on the thinking and on the quantification. But the bottom line is that we think they're excellent giving opportunities, and we want there to be a substantial allocation of them, but we don't want that allocation to be most of the capital. And so at this point, we're no longer... it's not really top of mind for us anymore, this idea about, you know, how that would affect GiveWell. It's more like we're just reserving that capital for other things, and that's why we're not fully funding. I'll take one or two more. Yep.
Presumably there's some focus areas you haven't even imagined yet. What is your process, for example, new focus areas you haven't considered? How do you estimate the value of those focus areas when you're trying to kind of make that explore-exploit trade-off of focusing on these different ones versus discovering new ones?
Sure. The explore-exploit trade-off, how do we think about focus areas we haven't thought of, and what do we do about those? It's a good question, and certainly I think there are probably focus areas we haven't thought of yet. For the most part, what we try to do is we try and take ideas that are out there and find the ones that are most promising to work on. So there are, you know, there's whole institutions that employ intellectuals that try to have new ideas. We don't really think of that as our main job. We try to think of our job as like, take the ideas that are out there, find the best ones, fund them. We do hope that by establishing this pattern where we fund very important, neglected, tractable things, we're making it more clear and more exciting to people, this idea that if you have an idea for a new focus area that we're missing, and you make that case, that good things will happen as a result of it. And so I think there are cases of people putting ideas out there that we wouldn't have thought of, and now we work on those areas and we're putting tens of millions of dollars into them. So I think that's one thing, is we're creating that incentive. We also fund some of the groups that we think are most likely to come up with the next big focus area we're missing. So we fund groups that try to build the effective altruism community, and the effective altruism community has historically been the people who think the hardest and the most about what are the causes where we might be able to do a ridiculous amount of good, and have come up with some of these focus areas or have helped highlight them to us. And so we fund some groups in that area, including like Future of Humanity Institute, which is basically, you know, we're funding people to think about both existing major priorities and how to do better with them, and what major priorities might not have been thought of yet. So one of FHI's main goals is to think of, you know, unknown causes, new causes. So those are some things we do. I mean, you know, I can imagine in the future we might do more intense things. We might announce some prize or something. But at this point, I think there are a lot of ideas out there. I think the ones that we're focused on are good ones to focus on. And to me, exploit looks pretty good. And I think the amount of exploring we're doing is like pretty appropriate. And we might flip that equation in the future. Let's see, it's 9:06. So I think I'm actually just going to call here. But I will stick around for questions for 20 minutes or so. So thanks very much for coming, everyone. I appreciate it. Yeah.